So the talk today is on simplicity of lifestyle, as you know. I have got a copy of the talk that I'll put up on the board afterwards, so you'll get quotes from that if you want to take them down. So I thought I'd start with a few reflections. So what does it mean to you to lead a simple life? Do you have visions of it being like Ryokan up his mountain, or Huineng pounding rice, or maybe Tenzin Palmo in her cave? Which is what I think it often has been for me. Do you believe it's possible to lead a simple life in the busyness of the world that you live in, particularly in an urban setting? And what do you turn to when you have a niggling feeling of emptiness or boredom or frustration? Where do you find pleasure? And how often do you think about the practice of the third precept? There might be questions that we'll look at in our group throughout the weekend. So I think we probably think, most of us, that we're pretty good at the third precept. I wonder if we really think about the third precept that much, because after all, we don't, I'm sure, rape or kidnap or commit adultery, which is the traditional things that you're not meant to do. But there's so much more to the third precept, and I think particularly when we think about it in terms of the positive precept, stillness, simplicity and contentment. So there's more and more depth to look at. So most of us aren't going to lead the sorts of lives of the people that I mentioned. It's just not the way we do live. So how do we move towards more simplicity of lifestyle, a simpler life, a simplicity of body, speech and mind, really? So this can be done within most lifestyles. And I do say most lifestyles, not all lifestyles. I know often Bhante gets quoted, this commitment is primary and lifestyle is secondary. And I think that what he's noticed over the years is that people then tend to think lifestyle means it isn't really that important. It's the commitment that is important. But actually it's secondary lifestyle. It is still important. So I think we can find a simplicity of lifestyle in most ways of living, but I was thinking, well, actually, you probably couldn't do if you were a drug addict who lived on the streets and was always just trying to find a way to get their next fix, or you're somebody who spends 8 hours a day working in an abattoir. There are certain lifestyles where it's going to be difficult to find stillness and simplicity and contentment. But given that that's an extreme and we're not at that extreme, it's like we don't want to feel that we have to go to the other extreme of being somebody who just sits on their cushion all day meditating, or sits with a cup of tea looking out the window at a very beautiful view. You know, things that we might do on solitary or on retreat, which definitely help. They do help that simplicity and contentment arise, but they're not prerequisites for it. In a way, if they were, we'd have to abandon all hope for stillness, simplicity and contentment now, wouldn't we? Because that isn't how we live. And the simple life can be a busy one. I think that's important to realise. So it isn't about necessarily having a completely spacious, quiet time. It can be busy, and it's also one which requires a lot of energy, because it means being active and conscious and disciplined. I like the word disciplined. Me and Shanta Badger were saying the other day, we like the word discipline. Not everybody does. But it just means training, really, for being one who trains. And Bhante wrote a little essay called The Simple Life some years ago. This is when he was living in India. So it's in the Crossing the Stream. So it was written sometime between 1949 and 1952. So it's very much, Bhante's language is quite different in those days. So he says this about The Simple Life. The simple life is also a strenuous one, being the product of a process of simplification, a reduction of life to its barest essentials. And the successful accomplishment of this process is, amidst the monstrous jungle growth of the complexities of modern living, a task calling for unremitting endeavour and inflexible resolve. So, as uncompromising as ever, Bhante. So we need unremitting endeavour and inflexible resolve in order to live the simple life. So he talks about a reduction of life to its barest essentials. So what are those barest essentials? Well, really, they're anything that leads to more positive states of mind, to more joy, more spontaneity, more creativity, ultimately to a lessening of the belief in a fixed self, and, ultimately to enlightenment. That's what we're trying to power our life down to. So the point of deepening the third precept and moving towards more stillness, simplicity and contentment is awakening, nothing less. That's what we're trying to do with this precept. So those of you that have done the Transcendental Principle Retreat know that Bhante in the survey says that the point of studying the Dharma is for the attainment of enlightenment. That's what it's for. So what we're doing here this weekend, looking at this precept and looking how to go deeper into this precept, is for the attainment of enlightenment. That's what we're doing. So Bhante is ever quite uncompromising. However, I would say that not all the discussion that we have over this weekend is necessarily going to be explicitly directed towards the attainment of enlightenment. I don't want you to curb your conversation and chatting with each other thinking, is this really dharmic? Because actually what you're doing is building up friendships and connections, and that is a path towards enlightenment as well. So the barest essentials may present slightly differently for each one of us. It's dependent on what we need. So consequently, we do have to be honest about what is helping us move towards stillness and simplicity and contentment, and what's actually just a justification for something that isn't doing that for us. So for me, and for a number of other people, Atarpani included, one of the things that helps us move towards stillness, simplicity and contentment is being taking the Anagarika vow. So as I mentioned last night, there are about 54 people in the order at the moment who've taken that vow. But there are a lot more other people who are also practising brahmacharya. They've not taken on the vow explicitly, but they are practising brahmacharya, and I'll come on to what that means in a minute. So the Bhante has said that if you're practicing brahmacharya, you've taken the Anagarika vow, what will naturally arise out of that is a fewness of possessions, careerlessness and homelessness. And sometimes he also adds the desire for communal living. So the actual precept that you take, the deepening of the third precept, is to abstain from all sexual activity. So that's the precept that you take on. But these other things will just naturally grow out of it as you go deeper and deeper with that practice. And in the essay, A Simple Life, he talks about this in terms of looking at it in terms of body, speech and mind, which he then says ultimately will become mudra, mantra and samadhi. I quite like that idea that if you really purify, I guess, your body, your speech and mind, they become mudra and mantra and samadhi. So we'll have a look at each one of those. So looking at body first. Well, of course, we're going to talk about the third precept. We talk about sex. And I was wondering about why particularly stillness, simplicity and contentment is the positive counterpart of abstaining from sexual misconduct. Because you could say, well, why are they not the positive counterpart of any of the precepts? Surely if we're practicing loving kindness, or not harming others, then stillness, simplicity and contentment would arise. Or if we're trying not to have slanderous speech but to have harmonious speech, stillness, simplicity and contentment would arise. So why particularly with this precept? And I think it could be because sex sexual desire are all consuming. I'm sure most people have experienced that at some point. It completely takes you over. And if you haven't experienced it yourself, you've probably seen it happening with your friends. It's what I refer to as the love bubble that can happen. You know, when people first fall in love and they just seem to vanish off into the love bubble, everything is to do with that person. And you become slightly peripheral to their lives at that point. It only happens for a period of time, that particular strength. But I think also in our culture we have a real strong romantic myth. I think in probably most cultures there's a strong romantic myth. For some reason, that film, Bridget Jones' Diary, or whatever it's called, came to mind. And I think there's a third one come out. So but that was a hugely popular film. People loved seeing, partly because of the character of Bridget Jones, but because of the relationship between her and Darcy. And apparently the third film's come out, or the third book's come out, and they've killed Darcy off. And there's been uproar. People are furious that she's killed Darcy off because it's ruined that romantic myth. You know, they're meant to live happily ever after. It's a very strong myth that we have in our culture. There's also, of course, the instinctive desire to procreate. So you may not have had a strong mothering urge. I personally have never had a mother urge in my life. But I think generally humans do have an instinctive urge to procreate. I think I heard once that in wartime the rate of pregnancy goes right up. So whether that is because people are facing their death, so they just want lots of enjoyment, so they have lots of sex, or whether it's because people are dying, so there is this sort of instinctive urge to repopulate. But we do have the instinctive urge to procreate. So culture values the couple. So it's a lot for us to go up against that, to try and work against just going with the flow and getting into relationship and, having sex as often or as freely as we can, depending on what sort of culture you're involved with. So I think it's much easier for us to be unconscious of all the things that go on around sexual relationships for us. In Living Ethically, Banti describes what he thinks sexual relationships actually are. He says, I suspect that in a majority of cases, sexual relationships are nicely judged reciprocal arrangements, balanced exchanges of services, physical and emotional, healthy enough on their own level, but not to be elevated above that level. So anyone who's in a relationship at the moment, you're having a balanced exchange of services. Your partner. So it's not that Banti or the Buddha are saying one shouldn't have a sexual relationship. They're not saying that, but they're saying see it for what it is. Be honest about its place in our spiritual life. You know, sometimes I've heard people say they've got into a relationship because it's a spiritual practice. And I suppose it would argue it's not. There's nothing wrong with getting into the relationship. And you can practice within the relationship. It's not that it's not a good arena for practice. It's a great arena for practice. But in and of itself, a sexual relationship is not a spiritual thing. So I became an Anagarika 5 years ago. And I'd wanted to be an Anagarika ever since I got involved with the movement. I'd always wanted to be a nun. Really, so, but I didn't quite want to go off and live in a monastery. I knew that wasn't quite me, because I also wanted to be a rock chick. So I became an Anagarika, and I think it was a long process to actually taking on that precept, even though I knew that's what I wanted to do. And I don't know why at the time I decided it was definitely the time, why I suddenly had such a strong knowing that now was the time. I was at a talk that the Dalai Lama was giving in Nottingham, and turned to my friend who I was with and said, I'm going to be an Anagarika. I meant like now. And she'd heard it so many years, she just looked at me and said, yeah, and then went back to reading the programme. And I meant now. So I'm not quite sure why I suddenly felt it so strongly there. But I do remember that there were always Q&A sessions at the end of his talks, and somebody had asked him about why monks were celibate. And he quoted Nagarjuna, and I remember the exact quote, and you hear it slightly differently, but basically he said, if you have an itch, you scratch it, but better is to have no itch at all. And I really like that idea, because we know what it's like when we have an itch and you scratch it, and there's that wonderful feeling of relief. But soon enough, there's an itch somewhere else, isn't there? And it's much nicer not to itch at all. So we have this sort of itch of sexual desire, so we scratch it, and it's lovely. But then there's another itch of sexual desire that arises, and that has to be scratched. So as an Anagarika, the feeling is better just not to have to keep scratching. So actually my experience of when I became an Anagarika was a feeling of liberation. Definitely a feeling of joy and of liberation and freedom. I realised that I'd felt that I'd shut the back door years before, because I'd been practising celibacy for years. But actually, taking on the gold caser, I realised the door had been just that fractionally bit open, and now it was shut, and I just felt such relief. Another one, Banti's aphorisms, is commitment is freedom. I think I really understood that at that point, that no longer, there was no bit of my energy, even subtle energy, that was going, oh, well, the maybe George Clooney will walk down the driveway. He's in Valencia at the moment. but
I know where he is.
I know where he is. I've had the parent to text me to tell me, get over here quick, George Clooney's here. 2 months too late for me. I was there 2 months ago. Anyway, so yeah, that's gone. There's no sort of idea of any possibility of a relationship, because that's not what I want. So now all my energies can just go be more directed into other areas, which is mainly around friendship for me. And I really noticed that the Anagarika convention, like I said, it was a mixed convention, and one of the guys had commented towards the end of it that he'd wondered about it being mixed, about how easy it would be to really share and be open and honest and transparent about quite intimate things, because we did talk about sex quite a lot. And actually, his experience and all our experience, I think, was actually people were incredibly transparent very quickly. And the thing is, because we knew there was no sexual sort of frisson between us. There was no possibility that we were looking at each other over the sort of the room and thinking, ooh, maybe I wonder what they're like. That just wasn't there. So we were very much treating each other as purely as individuals. I really, really appreciated that. It's just friendship based on the good, in a way, that we experience there. So like I say, the main thing that Anagarikas take on is practice brahmacharya. And again, there are lots of people in the order and the movement who are practicing brahmacharya who haven't taken on the Anagarika vow. Some people are moving towards that, some people just take on practicing brahmacharya for a period of time just to experience it and see what it's like. So brahmacharya in a way is about being single and emotionally independent and non-exclusive. And traditionally it's said to be a state of chastity and celibacy. So we usually refer to people being celibate, and I suppose that there's a slight difference between those. So chastity is a complete abstention from any sort of sexual activity at all. And celibacy just means to be single, to be unmarried. So I guess traditionally that if you were unmarried, it meant that you were chaste, because there wasn't sex outside marriage. But of course for us that's a bit different now. So in theory, I guess you could be celibate but not chaste. And actually you could be chaste but not celibate. You could be in a marriage but not having sex. So brahmacharya is both. It's a state of chastity and celibacy. So the reason for this, in a way, is because whenever we indulge in sex, we're indulging in craving. And it's a very strong craving. You know, it can be, if you haven't had sex for a while, it alleviates, doesn't it? It's not such a strong craving, but then as soon as you have sex again, that craving can become really, really strong again, and you just want more. It's like we get with other things, chocolate or whatever it is. But it's a strong craving. So we're acting from craving, whether it's craving for that pleasurable experience or the person involved in that, whether that person's there or not. You know, they don't actually have to be present. It might be a craving to be acknowledged, to be loved, to be met. Or simply a craving to alleviate that physical and emotional desire that's arisen. Bhante did a seminar in 1980 where he said, absence of desire is equivalent to absence of desired object as desired object. If you don't desire a woman, she ceases to be a woman. So what is she instead of a woman? She's just an individual. So I think it's a seminar for men, which is why he's talking about women. But he could equally have talked about men. So he could just say, you know, if you don't desire a man, he ceases to be a man. So what is he instead of a man? He's just an individual. And it's a bit what I'm saying, that's what I experienced on the Anagarika convention. There's a lot of projection in desire, and this takes up a lot of energy and mental space. Traditionally, the Buddha said to the monks to see women as their mothers, their sisters and their daughters, so that they wouldn't have that sort of desire for them. But actually, I think Bhante's gone one step on. He's saying, don't see women as a desired object. See women as an individual, or see man as an individual. So brahmacharya basically means faring or living like Brahma. So living like a sublime spiritual being who's transcended sexual dimorphism and dwells in the celestial realms. That's the ideal. So trying to transcend sort of a gender basis. So it isn't for everyone. So this weekend is to try and get you to all start practicing Brahmacharya. In Living Ethically, Bhante talks about some people maybe having a gift, as he calls it, a gift for chastity, and that we should support people who have that natural tendency towards practicing chastity and not think it's weird and try and push people into wanting a sexual relationship. But equally, if people want a sexual relationship, we shouldn't be pushing them into practicing Brahmacharya necessarily. But Bhante does say that he thinks we should all be trying to move towards it bit by bit. Again, another seminar in 1985, he said, no one probably is so celibate that he could not be more celibate, and also no one is so uncelibate that he could not be more uncelibate. So it's a spectrum. You know, we've still got, even if we're practicing Brahmacharya, we still have desires that we have to work with. And if we're not practicing Brahmacharya and we're involved in sexual relationships, there's probably still a part of us that desires more the simplicity of not being so caught up in that. So Brahmacharya is ideally a state of simplicity, equanimity, joy, a state of going beyond identification with gender. In Bhante's 15 points for order members, number 12 is move towards complete Brahmacharya. So again, he's encouraging us to keep that in mind. So we're not saying you have to practice Brahmacharya now, but just to start lessening our attachments bit by bit, trying to learn to dwell more in the sublime realms, being less dependent on the mundane world. So that's why meditation is so important. So retreats are very important, and I think particularly solitaries are very important, because that, at least we are at that point, we're away from other people who we might be projecting some sort of desire onto. We've still got our minds, and we can still have plenty of desires when we're on our own, but maybe it alleviates that possibility a little bit more. So how important is your sexual relationship? Say sexual relationship, whether you're having sex or not in that relationship. Just if I say how important is your relationship, you have loads of relationships, all your friendships are relationships. So I mean sexual relationship as in your maybe exclusive partnership. So do you give equal attention to your friendships, especially those friendships in the Sangha, who you do to your partner? So I'm thinking for a lot of people, friendships last longer than their sexual relationships do. And why is that? So I wonder if whether having an exclusive relationship with somebody lays a heavy burden on it. There can be something very positive about it, but it can lay a heavy burden on both that person and on ourselves. Friendship, it's not that friendships can't be party to that. If we're after a best friend, you know, that can also lay quite a heavy burden on that person to be our best friend and always there for us. But actually, if we have a number of friendships, there's less dependency on any one of them. So in Tri Ratna, we practice what I think of as a non-exclusive exclusivity. And I think particularly in terms of Kalyana Mitra relationships and our relationship with our preceptor, it is an exclusive relationship in that they're not the Kalyana Mitra or the preceptor to everybody. And we are very important to them and they're very important to us. But actually, they're also Kalyana Mitra to a number of other people. They're preceptor to a number of other people, and those other people are equally important to them. So it's a sort of non-exclusive exclusivity. So we do get that need met to be seen particularly by somebody, but it's not overly dependent. So it's a healthy, loving relationship, hopefully, not an overly dependent one. I want to look at money as well, our relationship with money. So I came across this quote, which I think is an expansion of a quote from somebody else, actually, but I liked the expanded one. It says, there are two ways to get rich. You can make more money or you can require less. It's quite straightforward. So I do doubt if many of us here are thinking that what we want to do with our lives is to get rich, financially to get rich. Spiritually maybe, but financially to get rich. But do we see requiring and wanting less as a valuable practice to make more conscious? Not just as a panacea for the environment. So often we can think we want to have less because we know it has an impact on the environment, but actually do we see it as a path towards insight and enlightenment? So of course out of this comes fewness of possessions. So it's not that you don't necessarily own things if you're trying to really simplify your life. You might own a car, you might own a house. Some Anagarikas own property. Anagarikas own cars. And this was a discussion that we had on the Anagarika Convention, people wondering about that. But basically, people own these things because they're necessary. If people need somewhere to live, people needed a car in order to get around. But they're not clinging to them. My house, my car. So you can own things, but not be overly attached to them. And one of the things that came out of the Anagarika Convention for me was this idea of not buying anything that I don't need for 6 months. So me and a friend have taken this on to do till June. We're actually meeting, I'm going to stay with her in June, so we were laughing that we'd go dashing out and go shopping with each other. But we won't. Because the tennis is on, we'll be watching that. But there's something about the reason we sort of decided to take it, because we've been talking about noticing that sort of frisson of excitement in a way, or a frisson of discomfort that comes out of excitement to go when you want to go and buy something. We said even when it's the idea if I pop into town to, I don't know, if I pop into town to go to the post office, then I think, oh, shall I pop into Morrison's and just get a bit of food for the community? Just wanting to buy something, anything, it seems to alleviate something. So not wanting to do that, it's not that I'm not going to buy food for the community who need it, but noticing that I'm, you know, I'll look and buy a DVD or maybe buy a CD or something. And I know that particularly used to be when a retreat would end. I think the retreat would end and I'd feel a bit of a loss of something. So I'd fill it by, I'd nearly always end up going to buy a CD, is the main thing. So try not to do that. So only buying what I really, really deem as necessary for a period of time and then see what the experience is. So to watch when that sort of urge to fill up that sort of hole arises with that wanting to go out and get something and then just being able to sit with that experience and see what happens. And actually, I mean, it's only been 4 weeks, if that. But actually, it already feels like it's a real pleasure in not getting sucked into consumerism. It's a real pleasure in not feeling that when I go into town that I'm going to get sucked into the charity shops, which is my downfall, actually, when I'm in town. It's like they're a vortex that pull me in. And actually, now I don't actually feel that I want to go in there at all. I suppose the next step would be able to go in there and just stand there and not buy anything. But, so yeah, learning to just stay with that feeling of edginess or something when that feeling comes up and not act on it. So I know I can live very simply and not need few possessions. I lived out of a rucksack for over 2 years and was quite happy doing that. You know, had very, very little with me for all that time. But as soon as I came back to this country and settled, I started accumulating. So compared to a lot of people, I might not have loads and loads of stuff. You know, I don't have a house load of stuff, but I have a room full of stuff, which I'm trying to sort of get rid of more stuff. I've managed to throw out quite a lot since I came back from the convention, but there is still a lot more to go. So it's trying to work out why I've accumulated. Is it for security? I own, therefore I am. Or is it just habit? Or is it just greed? There was a great thing that somebody, one of the women on the Anagarika Convention said that I think a lot of us are really taken with, that she talks about the spiritual life being like walking a tightrope, but we have a samsaric safety net underneath us, just in case the spiritual life doesn't work and we fall off the tightrope. And she said for a lot of people that samsaric safety net is relationship. So you think, oh well, if it doesn't all work, I've got my boyfriend, got my girlfriend, got my husband, got my wife, whatever. But actually for an Anagarika, of course, that aspect of the safety net isn't there. So then we sort of talked, people individually talked about, well, what was their samsaric safety net? And I think for me it's money. If being that I have some savings, and so I've got that to fall back on if it all goes to pot. So it's not that I should give all my savings away, but it is again about how I'm relating to those as a safety net. Because actually, as we know, the banks could go bust, could lose absolutely everything, and there'd be nothing there. So we do live in a different culture to the Buddha, so I think there is a need to have some savings if one's able to put some savings aside. We don't live in a culture where the laity are going to support us. We don't live in a culture necessarily where even the government is going to support us for much longer. They may or may not. But it is about how we relate to our savings at this point, and how much of those savings can we actually give away now? Is it that we've got plenty put aside, and we find even if somebody needs a loan of 25 quid or a donation of 25 quid, we hesitate, even though we've got, I don't know, a few thousand pounds in the bank? How attached are we to it? There's a sutta called the Anana Sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, where the Buddha describes four types of happiness for a lay person partaking of sensuality, he calls it. So he's basically talking to an Asapindaka. And the four types of happiness are the happiness of earning wealth, the happiness of using wealth, the happiness of debtlessness, and the happiness of blamelessness.
I'm automatically, it's happiness of earning wealth skillfully.
Yeah, no, I'm about to say that.
Sorry.
So those are the four that he talks about: earning wealth, using wealth, debtlessness, and blamelessness. So then the bits that I've added in are, it's earning wealth skillfully, and it's using wealth wisely. And he does say in this sutta that the one that is the most important is the last one, which is the happiness of blamelessness. So I quite like that sutta, because it's saying that it's not that earning and spending money can't bring enjoyment. It's the important thing to remember is that these are done skillfully and wisely and without incurring debt. So you might have heard that if you're in debt, you can't be ordained. So it doesn't mean if you have a loan with a bank or somebody's lent you money that you have a regular payment for. So it's not that. But if you've incurred a debt that you're unable to pay off, it's very difficult to then go off and pay for an ordination retreat in government for 3 months and not have that weigh on your mind. You need to pay off the debt first. So the happiness of debtlessness, you can go off and be ordained with that. So with the fewness of possessions, I know I'm definitely attached to a lot of my possessions, otherwise I'd be able to get rid of even more than I have done. But I've always loved this quote from Vidyavati. So some of you will know this. It was, I think, the first chapter of the Moon and Flowers book, when she's talking about seeing her house burn down. This is what she said. She said, "As windows exploded under the pressure of intense heat, and flames devoured a short lifetime of possessions, I sat in full lotus on the grass verge watching my house burn. On my face was a calm smile of inexplicable relief. I knew what it meant. I was now free to disentangle myself from the seductive tentacles of an escalating career and materialistic lifestyle, the dubious delights of four boyfriends, and the facade of being successful..." Yeah, four boyfriends. "And the facade of being a successful, outwardly mobile, professional woman with almost all one could wish for. My outward achievements barely concealed an inner emptiness." So I think it's very strong about her being able to really recognise that actually she had this inner emptiness, and these things that are burning down were not alleviating that, and she was free to start again. So that's fewness of possessions that's grown out of the Anagarika vow. And then careerlessness. When I wrote it up on my iPad the other day, it auto-corrected it to carelessness. We're not talking about carelessness, careerlessness. So it doesn't mean not having a job at all. It's interesting on the Anagarika convention that actually a lot of the Anagarikas didn't have a job because they tend to be, a lot of people are older, so they were retired. I think Tarpany and I were very much on the younger scale, so not desperately young. But still working. So yeah, obviously I have a job. Here I am doing it. But it's about not being invested in your job as security or trying to climb the career ladder for recognition and approval. Not wanting security, whether financially or emotionally. So I was really struck again on the convention when Manju Vajra talked about learning to be a nobody, or being his experience of being a nobody. And I really liked that, learning to be a nobody and not needing status. So careerlessness, very hard to say, especially with a lisp, is about not wanting that sort of recognition of here I am, see me, being able to just be nobody. So I think it's not just about having a job where that can come up. I think that can come up in the movement and in the order as well. So it's about not craving to be a private preceptor or a public preceptor, or not craving to be somebody who gets loads of invites to come and lead retreats or give lots of talks that are all over Free Buddhist Audio so everybody knows who you are. Just being happy to get on with one's practice and maybe not be hardly known at all in the movement and the order. You know, that can be a challenge. What matters most is your practice. If these other things happen, they happen. And if they don't happen, they don't happen. And it doesn't matter. So also with a job or with a career, what we're trying to do is earn enough to live on. Not earn enough to accumulate huge amounts so that we can drive the fastest car and have the latest gadget and the biggest house and the fanciest holidays or whatever it is that floats your boat. We're earning enough to live on and maybe enough to save for old age. Then the pastor, Banti, said that we should spend as little time as possible earning a living. And he did say when he said that, he does then explain that he's talking mainly to the young people. And I think this is one of the earlier talks that he gave. So there were more young people probably at the talk than happens nowadays. Because he's recognising that actually if you get somebody that they're very young, they're probably more free to not have to earn a lot because they haven't built up a lot of financial obligations yet. But still, even if we have got financial obligations, we've got children, we've got a mortgage or whatever it is, we still try and work as little as possible in order to meet those financial obligations. This frees up more time for Dharma practice, more time for involvement with the Sangha. So I know a lot of people who get involved with the movement then start trying to find if they can work one day less a week. And it's quite common that people try and work maybe 4 days a week instead of five. But the contentment aspect also comes from accepting the job that we've got. Fully engaging with whatever our work is and not going to work and dreaming of doing something different, wishing we had a different job, wishing life was different to what it is. Actually fully engaging in what we've got, whether it's something that we really love that's very creative, like producing art or caring in the caring professions, or it's stacking shelves and putting prices on goods to be sold. Those are all things that keep the world ticking over. They're all jobs that we can find a way to engage in imaginatively finding a way to involve our hearts in it more, find contentment in what we're doing. You know, some of the most menial jobs can be incredibly contentment inducing, having done some menial jobs. That's careerlessness. And I just want to mention briefly food. Just with simplicity of lifestyle, with food is a big area, I think, that just looking at things like, do we comfort eat? Or do we comfort not eat? Or another way that we can do, that we don't eat when we feel bad, or we overeat when we feel bad. I was really struck when I read about an experiment they did about overeating. So, you know, we get a plate full of food and we tend to try and finish it all, and then maybe go up for seconds because we think we're still hungry. But actually what they've done, they got people to eat blindfolded, And it nearly always people would not finish their plate of food because they weren't aware of what was on there. So they would eat until they were full and then they would stop. But actually when we can see the food, we're not that in touch with whether we're full or not. We're just trying to get all the food down. My mum used to say that thing, your eyes are bigger than your belly. Mm-hmm. But do we overeat? Do we get obsessed with planning meals? This can happen particularly on solitary retreats where there's not much else to do. For some people, I'm not a big one for cooking, so it doesn't happen for me, but I know it does for other people. Or wondering what you're going to eat next, which can happen on retreat. Can we let go of preferences? I mean, really let go of preferences. Not go, oh, well, it's only for this weekend. Oh, I'll eat whatever they put in front of me tonight. And that's not really letting go of a preference entirely. It's just not even letting go of whatever. No stoicism needed. Just, it's not an issue. So there might be a few of you who've taken this on, that there's this thing called Veganuary that's happening this month. So for people to become vegan for the month of January. And that's been something that I've been doing, which has been very interesting. And again, to try and sort of simplify things in some ways. It's a lot to do with the ethics of eating dairy products, but it's also about simplifying my life. So, yeah, we can think about something like that. We might decide to be vegan for a month and just see what our experience of that is. Well, the main thing that seems to have happened for me is meant it's taken out the choice when I go out for lunch with someone about whether I have cake afterwards or not. Because invariably the cake's not vegan. So again, that commitment is freedom aphorism has come to light. So I think what I might try and do is what Parami described as being a domestic vegan, which is when she's always vegan at home, but sometimes it's not always that easy, and she travels an awful lot. So she'll be vegan as much as she can, but vegetarian otherwise. So again, just trying to simplify in a particular way around the way I relate to food. So Banti, in this talk on A Simple Life, he mentioned speech. So I'm not going to say too much about speech, but obviously speech precepts are very important. We've got four of them. Once you get ordained, there become four speech precepts. And how rigorous are we with our speech? Do we see our speech as leading to stillness, simplicity and contentment? Banti says we should get to the point where no word is uttered without some spiritual recollection in it, which I think is a very high expectation, but one that we do need to take seriously, something we're trying to move towards. Because our speech really does temper our environment. What comes out of our mouth has an effect on the environment around us, both on the other people that are around, but also on ourselves. So how lazy are we with our speech? So the areas we might be lazy might be exaggeration. So I don't mean exaggeration when maybe you're using it as a humorous way of using it. But when you know that you're exaggerating to try and look, make yourself look more interesting, to big a story up, do you use exaggeration? Chinese whispers, I think, is a really important one. That inaccuracy is we relate somebody else's words to someone else through the filter of our own thoughts and ideas. I certainly felt, when I was a mitra, I felt very much I got on the sharp end of somebody having done that with me, where they fed back to another order member something they said I'd said, which was not what I'd said. It was filtered through their attitude towards me, and it caused terrible problems for quite a long time. I found it very, very difficult for a long time. So being really careful, if we're going to pass on something that somebody said, to put it in context and to use the words that they said. So not saying something like, I don't know, Julie says she's really fed up with the ordination training process and doesn't want to be in it anymore. And then people hear that and go, oh, she's withdrawing her ordination training process or withdrawing her request for ordination. That's what might get passed on if you have the Julie's, you know, withdrawing her request for ordination. And actually all Julie said is that she's having a bit of a hard time and it's a bit of an ordeal and she's finding it tough. So just being really careful about how we pass things on. Looking at how we get involved in gossip. But that can be a hard one. That can suck you in. A bit of like the vortex of charity shops. There's the vortex of gossip. And rants. Do we rant? Have a rant about things, and is there room for a therapeutic rant, which we sometimes had a discussion about do you go and say to your friend, I just need to get this off my chest, just going to have a bit of a rant, it's stop me when it's getting too much and then help me explore what's going on with me around that, rather than just going and just spieling off to somebody on and on and on. And what about our language when we're alone? I must admit my language gets more florid when it's an inanimate object, which is usually a computer. And I'm aware that when I get really angry and florid in my language, it is poisoning the atmosphere around me. I'm the only one there, but I can feel it having a bad effect on my mental states. I don't think it's that swearing always is bad. I was really struck by being told about this test that they did, that I think Stephen Fry was involved with. That they did this experiment where they got people to put their hand in a bucket of ice and see how long they could keep it in that bucket of ice. And actually, some people had to put it in the bucket of ice and just say a normal word. I don't know what the word was. Just like, I don't know, tree, 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 tree. And leave it in there as long as they could. And other people put their hand in and used a swear word. And the people that used the swear words could keep their hands in the bucket of ice for up to 40 seconds longer. So what they were showing, that actually it releases something that enables you to cope with pain more. So, you know, if you're using it for that, maybe it works. I don't know. But it's an interesting experiment. But it is about the mental state. It's about why you're using that swear word. Anyway, I won't go down there anymore. But it's an interesting area, I think. Okay, so let's go on to thoughts in the mind. This, of course, is the beginning of everything. What we think all comes out in action and speech. So we're probably not going to only think positive thoughts all the time. Positive, pleasant thoughts all the time. Very nice if we did. Yeah, very not. But we can learn not to perpetuate the negative ones, not to get caught up in papancha, the storylines that we create. So not to identify with them. I was really struck by Vijaya Mala came and did a few days with us up here last year, I think, and she did this 3-year retreat. And she said something like at the end of the 3 years in her meditation, she still had plenty of thoughts coming, but what the difference was that she wasn't identifying with them. And I think that's something that we can move towards. So it's not about stopping the thought necessarily, because we may not be able to do that, but not over-identifying with it, not believing the truth of it. So not creating the idea of a fixed self in that moment, not selfing. As soon as we start getting into papancha and creating a storyline, we're selfing. We're creating a fixed self. So how we work with thoughts is around attachment, non-attachment, non-exclusivity as a practice. So I wonder what our associations are with the word non-attachment. I'm going to keep going. So what are our associations with the word non-attachment? Indifference or detachment, coldness, alienation? Or do we see it about freedom and spontaneity and liberation? So I was thinking about the non-exclusivity, non-attachment. You can think in terms of the Karaniya Metta Sutta. Now there's that bit where it says, just as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so should one cherish all living beings. So that's the sort of non-exclusivity we're trying to move towards. So it's said that the mark of non-attachment is the absence of adhesion, as a drop of water runs off a lotus leaf. That's the traditional image, a drop of water running off a lotus leaf. I thought the more contemporary image that we use is to say it's Teflon, and it just doesn't stick. So when we get into craving and attachment, it means we want the object of desire to meet our need in some way. But non-attachment means that the object exists in its own right. We can appreciate it in its own right. It's not something there to fulfil our need. So that object could be anything. It could be any false refuge that we have. So a much more essential level of practice, in a way, is abandoning the skandhas. The something that got talked about a bit on the Anagarika convention as well. That's ultimately what we're trying to do, is abandon the skandhas, abandon the idea of a fixed self. And for most people, it probably does mean having time away from the world. So some people will feel that you can actually abandon the skandhas in the midst of your busy life, and some people might be able to do that. But for most of us, we need to go on retreat. We need to go on solitary. We need that time to just have a bit of space to really sit and watch what's going on in our minds, how we're creating ourselves. I think, you know, the Buddha created a monastic tradition, and there was a reason for that. I mean, there were a number of reasons for that. But actually, he could see that you couldn't practice necessarily quite so deeply in a householder life. So he created a monastic tradition so people could go and practice more deeply. But we're not living in quite that sort of world now. But it doesn't mean that we can't find ways to go on retreat, to meditate a bit more, do a little bit less at home in certain ways, that we've got a bit more space to just sit and look out the window with a cup of tea. I'm a great advocate for sitting looking out the window with a cup of tea. So on a daily basis, what we can try and do is see our preferences and our views. So keep checking. When something comes up, you've got a view about something, you just keep checking, is this an I, me or mine coming up here? This is my view. This is the way it should be because I think it should be. We can just sort of bring a reflection to that every time that happens. And seeing that actually there's a ridiculousness about that, because actually that view is probably changing. And all the other people in the world have got a different view, so which one's the right view? So what would it feel like if we weren't the centre of the universe? How freeing would it be not to have the whole universe revolve around us and us be the thing that it pins on? I think this is the ultimate homelessness. Not necessarily the homelessness that's talked about in the Anagarika vow. That's more about non-attachment to living somewhere in particular. But actually we're trying not to attach to living in our bodies, thinking this is an I inhabiting this body. There's just there isn't an I there. So to come back to Banti in the essay The Simple Life, he says in that, the more rigorous the simplicity of the outward form, the more clearly is the significance of the inner spirit revealed. So I'll say that again. The more rigorous the simplicity of the outward form, the more clearly is the significance of the inner spirit revealed. So I think the less we have outwardly, the less objects we hold on to, the less work we commit to, the less relationships, the exclusive relationships we invest in, the more we have to depend on our inner life, richness of our inner life, our receptivity to the transcendental, our openness to the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. There must be a joy for simplicity to flourish, but as we practice more and more simplicity, that joy will just grow more and more as well. There has to be a richness in our life. So we need pleasure in the spiritual life. So all this talk of giving up sex and careers and possessions and stuff may not sound very enticing, or even the idea of just lessening our attachment to them. But we can only do those things if we have something to replace it. I'm not saying give all these things up and be stuck in a rather blank void with nothing pleasurable in it. So this is Banti and the Yogi's Joy. He says, if you don't replace them with pleasures that will draw you towards a higher purpose, your energy will get stuck and may even force its way out in disagreeable ways. The main point is that enjoyment is not a luxury, something peripheral to the main business of practicing the Dharma. It is not an element to be introduced if there is time. It is central to the whole exercise. There has to be joy, otherwise we just can't practice. So we need to look for skillful mundane pleasures and really appreciate and enjoy them to help us sort of move towards more stillness, simplicity and contentment. So what can you do practically to simplify your life? And it doesn't have to be huge. I was thinking about the difference between liposuction and diets. So liposuction is this huge thing, isn't it? You can get whole fat taken out. But apparently research has shown that the fat just comes back again over time. And apparently even it turns up in places where it wasn't liposuctioned out. It's a short-term solution that doesn't work. Whereas dieting, the idea with dieting is if you do a diet that you lose just a pound a week, say very, very slowly diet, again, research has shown you're more likely to keep that weight off. So you do something slowly and gradually. You acclimatise to it, you're more able to maintain it than if you liposuction or your preferences away. So what's your preferences and desires and try to be looser around them. So some things you could do is you could look through your wardrobe and look to see if there are any clothes in there that you haven't worn for over a year, say, and give them to the charity shop. You may do, as I've done, decide that for a period of time you're not going to buy anything that you don't deem necessary. You have to be really strict about what one deems as necessary. I'm sure there's lots of curves in that one. You might decide to try being vegan for a while, for a month, or vegan when you're at home or something. You might decide to be a bit more selective about what you watch on TV, if you're a big TV watcher. It's not about not watching TV necessarily, but it's about what you watch and how much you watch. Meditate more. Maybe try and meditate. If you meditate in the mornings, maybe try and sit for 20 minutes before you go to bed as well. Get on retreat as much as you can, or get to days at your centre. Do things that bring you pleasure as well. So it can be all sorts of different things. I think one of the things that's pleasurable for me at the moment is I'm teaching myself Spanish with the help of some CDs. And I don't consider myself any good at languages, but I'm absolutely loving it. And one of the things it's helping me do is when I've got a little bit of space, so I've got half an hour and I can do a bit of Spanish, that otherwise I might be off just rummaging around the net, seeing what special offers are on, except John Lewis or something. So I'm still doing something entertaining and something a bit more helpful. So find what skillful pleasures bring you enjoyment, and then use them to lessen your attachment to your tendency to acquisition, having acquisitions. Acquisitions aren't just things, they might be people, trying to get lots and lots of people, lots of friends, lots of relationships. Or it could be activity. You might be somebody who tends to get very, very busy and fills your time up always doing something. So find some pleasures that help you just slow down a little bit. So just end with some words from the Dhammapada. Look within, be still. Free from fear and attachment, know the sweet joy of the way.